My name is Sam Clements, and welcome to this special edition of the Picture House podcast, all about Peter Jackson's new film, They Shall Not Grow Old. Unusual for Peter Jackson, this film is a documentary, not a big special effects extravaganza like we have seen from him in recent years. He is, of course, best known for the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit trilogies, as well as things like King Kong, The Lovely Bones, a bunch of really interesting and gory films from New Zealand in the early 90s as well. Would recommend checking out his back catalogue. But this is his first ever documentary, and it's quite interesting. It's entirely made up of archive footage from the Imperial War Museum in London. Footage that's, over 100 years old in some cases, and Peter Jackson and his special effects team, who did work on Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, they have painstakingly gone through this black and white silent film, and they have upgraded it. They have brought it up to a modern frame rate so it doesn't look like people are walking around like Charlie Chaplin. He has colorized it in some cases, and he has actually managed to use a lip reader to work out what some of the real people were saying, and has cast voice actors to recreate some of their dialogue as well. So it's this really unusual and totally unique experience, and it's incredibly immersive, because in some cinemas you will see this film is also in 3D, and I know 3D is sometimes a little bit controversial. I like it when it's done well, and this 3D is some of the best I've ever seen. It's quite remarkable when you do see the colorized modern frame rate 3D version of what happened in real life so many years ago. It's incredibly moving, and it's this incredible sort of summary, really, because it is only 90 minutes long, and he had hours and hours and hours of real footage. I think he says in this interview he has hundreds of hours of footage that he's went through, but I think they've done a really good job of sort of kind of touching on key moments for people throughout the conflict, not politics or press or any of that stuff. This is all from soldiers' point of view, and he's done a really good job of talking about, before, during, and after. And the footage they have is just remarkable. As someone who went to school in the UK, the First World War is taught, I think, a number of times across the curriculum, and we always see the same type of pictures and the same shots and the same stories. This is a completely new perspective, and maybe one that wasn't able to be shown before this film was made, because of the access Peter Jackson had and the overview he got through this. There's also this amazing narration, which was recorded with veterans in the, I think he says in an interview, in the 60s. So he's using elements which have been outed, and these are all hidden in the BBC archive. So elements that have not been available, and he's brought them all back and packaged them up into this very sort of modern presentation. The film is totally unique. It is an event. It is playing in cinemas right now. It had a special one-off live event, which is why we recorded this interview with Peter Jackson when he was over for London Film Festival. That event sold out so quickly. Everyone wanted to see this film and wanted to hear Peter Jackson speak. Due to popular demand and the upcoming First World War Memorial, the film has been re-released only a sort of a month after its London Film Festival premiere. So listeners in cinemas from the 9th of November and at various points across November, across Picture House cinemas and other cinemas around the UK, the film has been re-released with the London Film Festival Q&A hosted by film critic Mark Commode, with Peter Jackson himself talking about this film. So if you go and see this film in cinemas now, it will say on the website where you book your tickets, but you will probably see the film They Shall Not Grow Old, followed by a Peter Jackson Q&A recorded from the London Film Festival. And I think it's really good to have that extra insight. Again, I was so lucky to talk to Peter Jackson whilst he was over for the London Film Festival, and our interview will touch on some of the things, but we didn't have all the time in the world, and this was a very long project. So we've got about 20 minutes or so with Peter Jackson talking about making this film. But if you do see the film in cinemas with that recorded Q&A, I think you'll get even more insight. Right, so that is more than enough from me. Without further ado, I will pass you over to legendary director Peter Jackson. I was genuinely starstruck. I love his films, and particularly Lord of the Rings. I do think they're incredible, but I think everything he does is really interesting, and I am so glad he has done something completely unexpected. Not a big Hollywood blockbuster, but this documentary with the Imperial War Museum, and he's made this film available for us all to see. I think after the film has finished screening in cinemas, every school in the country, in the UK, will be given a DVD version of this film to show to the class. So that's a good news story at the end of this film project. Right, without further ado, Sam Clements, Peter Jackson, talking about They Shall Not Grow Old. The film is back in cinemas. Would highly recommend seeing it on the big screen. Enjoy! Thank you so much for talking to us today, Peter.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. We've played, I think, all of your films since I've been working at the cinemas. I started
thank you.
Probably when Lovely Bones came out, and then we had a bunch of Hobbits.
Yes.
And now They Shall Not Grow Old, which is really unlike anything I've ever seen, and I think unlike anything our audience will ever have seen.
Well, it's interesting because it doesn't do anything other than use archive film and audio recordings from the veterans, which, you know, so I didn't create any of this. It pre-existed. But, you know, I think that what we did do, which hasn't really been done before, is we used all of our computer technology in New Zealand when we do our visual effects. We use that to restore the film to a degree that I think goes beyond what anyone's ever seen before. I mean, I didn't know it was actually possible. I was interested in what we could do with it, and I thought that, you know, we'll try. And I asked the Imperial War Museum to send me 2 or 3 minutes as a test, you know, just 2 or 3 minutes, scan it, 2K to send down, so I could have a play around with it. And I was, when we finished our work, and, you know, we finished figuring out how to restore it, I was amazed. I mean, it went so far beyond what I even imagined in my wildest dreams it would be like.
So with those 2 or 3 minutes of footage, how did you approach that?
To restore old film, it's sort of, you've got to look at each of the issues that old film has, and each of them has a separate process. It's not this one, it's a multitude of things. So, you know, you've got to look at the grain, it's all very grainy, so you want to reduce the grain. Scratches you've got to get rid of. Often, actually, you know, one thing that people don't really think about is often it's very dark or very light because it wasn't exposed properly or it's been duplicated badly over the years. And so it's a simple part. We just sort of graded it out. And it's amazing, from the Imperial War Museum gave us some film that was almost jet black.
Wow.
And we were able to get the image out of it and it looks fantastic, you know. So there's a lot of, you know, computer technology, you can do a lot of that sort of stuff with films. You've got to then look at the shaking, because old film shakes because it's so old that the sprockets have shrunk, the film itself, and even though it's been duplicated over and again, it's shrunk, and so it doesn't, you know, it sort of jumps up and down and sort of jitters all over the place, so you've got to stabilise it. And then obviously, you know, one of the, you know, key things which everyone first thinks about an old film is it's so fast and speedy. So you've got to, you know, we want to bring it all back to normal speed and project it 24 frames. But that's actually relies on you knowing exactly what speed the cameraman shot it at. Like you actually can't do it unless you know the exact speed that he shot it at, which we obviously don't know, and we never will. So that was a trial and error thing. Because I lived with the belief all my life that generally silent movie was 16 frames a second. It was, you know, and I just realised with this film it's actually not. We had over 100 hours of film, and it just wildly varies from 10 frames a second. There's a lot of it at 10 frames a second, which is crazy. And it goes to, yeah, most of it, the average is at 13 frames, 14 frames. Some tiny bit at 16 frames, tiny bit at 18 frames. So you've got to actually establish, you can't do it until you establish exactly what the original frame rate, because you want to end up at 24, but you've got to know this is a 15 frames a second, and the computer will, you know, get the computer to give you 24 frames, and so it sort of averages out the frames. It creates frames in between. It takes the before and after frame, and it builds a whole new frame. And it does that, obviously, differently, whether or not it's dealing with a 12 frame a second or a 10 frame a second or a 15 frame. It's the same technique, but it has to know what the missing frames, what the speed rate is in order to do what it has to do. So that was interesting. But we did that, you know, most people, you know, people often slow old film down for a TV documentary, but they slow it down in the simplest way, which is just to slow it down. But you still get the jerkiness, but it's just, you know, it's sort of, in theory, there's a lifelike speed, but it's very jerky. But I just wanted it to be smooth. So we got our computers to extrapolate all these frames and to construct all these frames that weren't even there in the first place.
Oh, wow.
And it, you know, it's pretty remarkable. I was surprised. I haven't never done it before, and it was surprising what you can actually do. But we had to develop a bit of software for it and everything else. So. Yeah, but the thing that comes out is the humanity of these people. Once you do all of that process, what you get from it is these people are human beings suddenly again. Mm-hmm. They're not Charlie Chaplins racing around with rifles in their hands. They're actually living, breathing human beings.
Absolutely.
It's just a remarkable transformation, and remarkable how magnetic these faces are. You just can't take your eyes away from these faces when you get it, you know, all the everything done, restored, all the speed right.
It's like it is a true window to the past, because people don't dress themselves this way anymore, and they don't have that same attention to detail with the grooming. You know, they're in the front line and they're still shaving, and it was really nice to see that detail. And also because it's home movie footage, people do look into the lens, which
that's the thing with the First World War footage. There's there's several different categories that I came to realize once I looked at 100 hours of it, and we saw 100 hours of it. You know, it's very specific. There's like, if they're not in danger, the soldiers, you know, if they're behind the lines or they're in having a rest, they're doing fatigues or they're behind, you know, they get incredibly distracted by the camera. Because when you think, you know, some of these guys have probably never seen a movie camera in their lives. Most of them have probably been to the pictures. Most of them have probably at this point in their lives been to the movie theater and seen Chaplin or seen whatever the films were. But they've probably never actually seen the camera that actually produces the picture, because that would be a very rare thing for an average person to actually ever get a glimpse of. So they're absolutely kept. They know they're being filmed, but they haven't never seen the thing that actually does this filming, and they're looking at it, and they're very self-conscious because they've had photos where they have to stand still, you know, for a period of time, and they don't know if they have to stand still, they don't know if they can move. They suddenly get sort of frozen, and it's kind of funny. It's funny to see them reacting, and they get distracted very easily by the camera. I mean, they often smile and laugh and all this sort of stuff, but then you the cameraman would also then rush to the first aid stations after a battle, and they're all coming in, shot to hell, and they were not interested in the camera then. They probably didn't even know the camera was there. There ain't no smiles at the camera then. They're like got bullet wounds all over their bodies. There's people trying to save lives. Everyone's doing their job, and it's a very, you know, serious job. The medics are trying to save these people. There's horrific wounds. These guys are coming in like almost unconscious, and no one's interested in the camera then. The cameraman is completely invisible, just filming this. And that's the other side of the footage, is that you get patches of this incredibly graphic and very powerful real stuff, yes. You know, which is not combat footage, but it's post-combat, and it's incredibly strong, and the, you know, it's the real thing. It's and you realize, well, this isn't guys clowning for the camera. This is actually the camera filming some pretty serious stuff going on.
And you also, you don't often see that stuff as a member of the public. You know, we often learn about this in school, and it's usually, you know, sort of toned down for schools. So to see it in color and to see red World War imagery, you just don't see that, because it's always in black and white. And that's what really got me, especially seeing the horses. I also didn't quite realise just how much they used horses in World War One.
Even when by towards the end of the war, when mechanisation was coming in, you know, there were certainly trucks and you know, tractors and all sorts of things by the time the war finished. You know, the petrol engine was certainly coming into its own. They still use horses a lot, because that was the only thing that could drag things through mud. You know, the vehicles would all bog down, even the tanks would bog down. So to actually get supplies to the front line or get supplies through the mud, horses were still the best thing to use. Yeah. So even though horses were the king at the beginning of the First World War, the horses it was a horse-drawn world, and by 1918 it certainly wasn't anymore. The horse-drawn world had virtually, you know, disappeared. The horses were still had a military use if it was very muddy and boggy and stuff. Yeah.
You also have this amazing footage of people using trains, which again I've never seen that before.
Yeah,
they're laying the train tracks.
The entire Western Front was covered with light rail. There's, you know, two-foot gauge rail. The British Army made I don't know how many miles, thousands of miles of light rail. And you think about it, that was a sensible thing too, because the First World War, being, you know, it's largely a static war. In other words, you know, you had your soldiers sort of stuck in one spot, front line. You know, it was a war of getting supplies to them. You had to supply, you know, food, ammunition, first aid. Everything had to be, it was a war of transport. It was like, you know, everything had to be taken to them. And so it's obvious. I mean, light rail, when you think about it, you know, is a really efficient way of doing it. It's you know, it's a good way of doing it. So there was thousands of miles of light rail all over the Western Front, yeah.
And you include that nice note about how, obviously, the steam train will give away your location.
Originally, it was steam trains, and then the Germans would see the steam, you know, and they'd sort of shill it. So I think, I don't know whether there are any diesel trains even existed. Like, probably the diesel train was most probably invented because of the trenches in the First World War, because they certainly, you know, when you think about it, steam was all that there was around then, and suddenly they're using diesel trains, which I doubt whether they even existed before the First World War.
The film itself is a really, it's only, you know, it's 90 minutes, but it's really comprehensive, and it takes you through some major sort of touch points. Did you always have that sort of narrative in mind when you were working on this project?
No, not really. I didn't really have it. I didn't know what I was making, and I was letting it make itself. You know, to a degree, like, when I started restoring the footage, I didn't know what I was going to make, but I was thought, well, let's restore this, see what we can do with the restoration, and we'll figure out what we're going to do. And then once I saw the restored footage, with these faces coming to life, and I thought, well, this has got to be about these humans. What I'm getting from this restored footage now is the humanity. I'm getting the people. I'm realizing these are. I've seen this footage before, you know, for years, and I'm seeing it now for the first time. I'm seeing them as human beings for the first time. So that's the story I want to tell. So at that point, it became a documentary, not about the First World War, which is not. It's about, you know, it's very specifically about the average experience of a British soldier on the front line in the Western Front. And so, you know, the average soldier on the front line in the Western Front didn't have a clue about the tactics and strategy. As one of them says in the film, you know, our entire life was what we saw in front of our eyes. Mm. And that was it, because they were not made privy to all the plans and strategies and tactics. They were not told anything. They didn't know what the guys, you know, a half mile down the road were or weren't doing. They didn't have a clue. You know that was deliberately kept from them. So you know, it was all about our world, our experience of the war was what we saw, and we didn't know anything else. And so, but by that nature, you know, all these interviews that I had, all these audio interviews, 600 hours worth, you know, I don't have, you know, it's not historians talking about the Passion Battle of the Somme. It's soldiers who were there who were just talking about what they were seeing. You know, they don't talk about the big, you know, what the generals were thinking or what the strategy was, because that wasn't their world. It was their world of what they lived in. And that appealed to me. It was like, well, we've seen lots of documentaries that explain to us the geopolitics of the war and strategy and the tactics and why the Somme was fought and why, you know, this and that. And, you know, and it treats the men just as sort of chess pieces in this great grand story. And so I wanted to do the opposite. I wanted to not... I didn't want to worry about what the chessboard looks like. I just wanted to tell the story of the pawn, and not about any of the other pieces on the board.
It makes it so relatable as well, hearing about these people, because that audio narration is such a gift, and it's so relatable, and just people describing, especially towards the beginning, about the sign-up process, people faking their ages and people being told off by old ladies in the street for not signing up. And that really struck a chord with me.
Yeah, and the other thing with the audio is, you know, obviously I had, you know, great access through the IWM and the BBC for audio, but I did say to them both, I said, can you just, you know, start by giving me audio that hopefully you recorded in the 1960s and 70s. I want it to be as younger veterans as we can possibly get. And there was limited recording done before, you know, the 60s of any grade, yeah. Because some of these recordings I got from the 1960s were like 10 hours long, one guy, like 10 hours were, you know, very, very comprehensive, some of them, which are fantastic. So I... I sort of made the deliberate choice to try to limit all my audio to the 1960s and 70s. And it was still good quality. The BBC had made this show called The Great War, which is a documentary series on the First World War. They'd made that in 1963, and they had at that time, they'd recorded and filmed over 200 veterans, which they only used a tiny bit. So I asked the BBC to dig into their archives and give me all the tapes from those interviews, which they found, and they kept finding them. They sent me a whole bunch, and then they said, oh, we found some more. Then a few months later, and we found some more. And I was eventually getting tapes that they hadn't even written the name of the guy on the tape, because they hadn't used it in the show, and it was found in an old shelf, and the records had been lost. So we were getting, you know, but that was fantastic resource. And they were guys that were young enough. I mean, they're really only 7 or 8 years older than I am now, you know, so I don't feel too old.
When I was watching the film, I was really wondering, like, where's this actor's reading memoirs? And you get to a point where, no, this is obviously not actors.
Every bit of VO is a real veteran. There are about 120 different guys. Like, I don't know how many I heard 600 hours worth. I don't know, there must have been about maybe 200 different guys. So, and I wanted to tell a story of what it was like. In a common story, I didn't want uncommon. So if some bloke goes off on a tangent telling some elaborate story about what he and his mate did, well, that was him and his mate. It wasn't the average story. So I didn't use anything that was too kind of specific to a particular person. I tried to make it sort of generic, you know, interesting and surprising, but still, I wanted it to be on the whole, you know, the average story of what an average soldier would have been experiencing. So I was telling one story with 200 different voices, really.
That sounds like an incredibly challenging thing to wrangle.
Well, it's only challenging in the sense you've got 600 hours that you've got to listen to, and then you've got to listen to it again and one more time. You know, I mean, I listen to that stuff a lot. So the time on the film was spent actually, there's more time spent just listening to the audio and watching the film, of 100 hours of film, than there would have been on actually sort of chopping it all together, you know. I mean, that took a bit of time as well, but before you can start to edit the film, you've got to listen to it all and watch it all. So we spent quite a few months just making notes and listening. And as we listened to it, if something really stuck out. You know, oh God, that's a pretty interesting thing. We would just, you know, we would mark it up to return to it later as a, you know, as a possible use in the film.
Are there any bits in the film now which you sort of remember when you first saw it and you knew that has to go in the film?
There's a few bits. I mean, there's one line that gets me a lot. And it's sort of, and unfortunately in the movie, it's at a point when there's quite a few sound effects. So I think some people miss it, but it was actually a line that I found really emotional, where somebody says, well, my memory of the war was one where people were kind to each other. That my overriding memory of that war was there was a kindness that we had to each other, which fundamentally must mean that, you know, it was kinder than the civilian life before and after. Because when you're in the trenches, there's no reason to hold grudges. It wasn't like, you know, you weren't picking on the other bloke in the unit. You know, there wasn't that sort of nastiness. Clearly, there was like, you know, you were together. You survived. You relied on each other to survive. You shared things with each other. You looked after each other in a way that probably they never experienced in their civilian life. You know. And so a few soldiers talk about that. They talk about just the, and people, what we do today is we call it comradeship, you know, and it's a bit of a cliche, but I sort of understood what comradeship is, I guess I should say. And there's another line, the thing that gets to everybody, I'm told, when they see it, they come out, they talk about the bloke who killed his own soldier because he was wounded and he had to kill him. And that was pretty emotional. Because you hear stories about, you know, sometimes British would, you know, if they came across a really badly wounded British soldier, they'd shoot him. But I never actually heard a recording of somebody actually having done that. I read it mentioned in books, but I never actually heard, I shot this guy because he was wounded and he did. And that was, you know, clearly even several decades afterwards, it still affected him hugely. You know, not shooting German or anything, just shooting his own wounded comrade. So that's certainly, and the thing that the line in the film that I think stands out too as possibly the best example of what the experience of an average soldier in the Western Front was, and I think it does, when I think look back on it now and having heard everything I've heard, and it wasn't what I expected. When I started this film, I would never have even thought this, but I think this is, it wasn't the war that we thought it was in terms of how people experience it. But there's one guy that says, that being in the trenches was basically like an extended Boy Scout camping holiday with a little bit of danger to spice things up. And I think that actually, really, I honestly think that is a very accurate, you know, nutshell description of what the First World War was like to soldiers. Not what we think it was like, but to them, that's what they regarded as. They actually kind of, most of them say they kind of enjoyed it. You know, they didn't enjoy the killing, and they say that they didn't. You know, they said it was horrific at times, and they saw appalling things. But on the whole, it was. You know, you even have a lot of people saying, if I had to do it again, I'd do it all over again because I actually enjoyed it.
That's really powerful.
I think we can't for the life of us understand why people would think that. Why? You know, we've already imprinted this image of the First World War as we sent a generation into the mincing machine and we slaughtered them all. And that's true, but that doesn't take into account what they themselves actually thought of being put through the mincing machine and being slaughtered. And when you listen to the lack of self-pity and the lack of victimization and the lack of blame, it was a job. They knew it was going to be tough, one guy says, and it was tough. But they took it, and they weren't surprised how tough it was. They went into it with their eyes open, and they just got through it. And they talk as very professional people, very pragmatic, very like we could, if we felt sorry for ourselves, you know, it wasn't going to help anybody, so we didn't. We just got on with the job, you know. And they still had that attitude many decades later. That's how they saw it.
Absolutely, yes.
And yet they're all dead now, and we've now imprinted this sort of victimization on them. We've, you know, victimized them on their behalf when they themselves didn't actually feel that way. You know, now that's not to say the First World War was a holiday camp, and it wasn't. And you know, the one thing that I always think, and I thought about a lot when I was working the film, this is the attitude of soldiers towards the First World War, but I thought they're the voices that we're not hearing that we don't have are all the soldiers that got killed. And I'm thinking, well, they would probably have something entirely different to say. I don't think they would agree with what a lot of these guys actually say, the people that really lost their lives in the war. The guys that we're hearing about are the ones that actually lived to be old men.
Yes.
You know, and I think they have the privilege of looking back at the war with a survivor's point of view. And there clearly were, you know, nearly a million British soldiers that didn't survive, and I think they would view it somewhat differently. But unfortunately, we haven't got their voices, so we can't tell their story.
No, that's true. Thank you so much for talking to us, though, Peter. We can't wait to play this film in our cinemas, and I think it will be a good national moment when people watch it on the 16th of October.
I really hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.